Blog Talk Radio.
Time now for Lydia's Literary Lowdown on Greater Good Ministries Radio. Join Lydia at 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern every Saturday and get the lowdown on today's popular authors, publishers, and pundits. Lydia's Literary Lowdown, right here on GGM Radio, every Saturday, 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern.
Welcome to Lydia's Literary Lowdown. I am Lydia Aswolf, and I have with me the terrifically talented David Beeson. I am so into his work that I actually forgot about this show in literally describing the amazing character work he's done in the work I've been privileged enough to see. If you have not read David's work, I think you should run, not walk, run to David Beeson, and it's B-E-E-S-O-N, David Beeson, randomviews.blogspot.com. He's got a hilarious blog up, but you can see his range in that it's hilarious. I mean, I laughed at his blog, and then I scrolled down past it, and then my face fell in a good way. The best authors are those who can produce emotion in us, and David just absolutely shines at that. David, how are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Lydia. Thank you for
that
introduction.
Really, tonight. I think tonight is much better because obviously you're in the UK.
I am indeed, and it's dark.
And everyone usually typically thinks that I'm going to have a British accent because I've done work for, well, I do work with a lot of UK clients. And a disclaimer, David, that you'll need as well as the audience, in that sometimes I'm not Madonna, I'm not Gwyneth Paltrow, I don't espouse trying to fake a British accent, but when I talk to people from the UK, sometimes I will mirror them just a bit. So forgive me, and please don't call me a poser, please.
No worries, not at all. And
now,
I think Gwyneth Paltrow's accent's rather good, actually.
What, mine? Because everyone loves a British accent in the States.
Gwyneth Paltrow's British accent is impressive, as is Gillian Anderson's. She's on
I thought Gillian Anderson was actually from the UK or raised there at some point.
Maybe she has that background. Maybe that's what helps her speak with a good English accent, specifically Southern English accent, and do it so well.
It's fabulous. But we are here to talk about your work. And while I was so busy forgetting I actually had a show to run, because I was so immersed in your characters, you told me that you are thinking about getting one of your books out there and submitting to an agent. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Yeah, well, my experience, I've had the 30 years experience or so of working in various businesses of different sizes. So if you like, that's the backdrop to the book. I think not a lot of people write about experiences of that kind. If they talk about businesses, it all tends to be corporate executives of large companies making huge oil deals and so forth. But I think a huge number of people, many millions of people, work in small or medium-sized companies, and they deal with office politics and all the rest of it. So I'm hoping that the kind of thing I'm talking about is going to be very familiar to a great many people. I hope actually it'll be quite familiar to an awful lot of people, because even though it's happening in a business context, the kind of tensions and friendships and collaborations and conflicts that you get obviously mirror what happens in life generally. And that's very much the case of this particular book, which is called Good Company, which is about a young man who comes to London. He leaves teaching to go into business, and he does it because he's very much in love with a slightly older woman than himself, and he finds himself very quickly caught up in a spiral of politics and bitterness within the company. And I think that I've tried to keep it all, I hope I've kept it all plausible. All of it, I hope, is realistic in the sense that it's based on, to a very great extent, many experiences of my own. Though I've perhaps given them a bit of an edge in the sense that you do get death rearing its head, which I have to admit doesn't happen that often in business, though it does happen occasionally. So he gets caught up in all this, people die around him, and ultimately he discovers that a great many events that he's been wrapped up in and which seemed disconnected from each other were actually all part of the same thing, and that, I'm hoping, is the interest of the book.
Well, I think your character is the interest of the book. You know, as I was telling you before we came on, you render all your characters beautifully. And this can be told by a few chance encounters with people that I, having been privileged enough to read Good Company, I despise them on sight. But your narrator, as it were, Martin, who is the protagonist, you wanted to protect him. I mean, he's moving in a world that he's not accustomed to moving in. And whatever, what I really like and what I think should sell your books is the fact that you make it all so very accessible. You describe the business world, which I believe most people would yawn at the thought, right? But I read it, and I learned so many things, and because Martin is a character who is entering this world, you just effortlessly describe what it's like to be in that world. Did that come naturally because you worked for 30 years in the field?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I actually wrote the first draft of this book nearly 20 years ago. It's now very different from what it was then because I left it for a long time. But at that time, obviously, I was newer, or was closer to my first entry into that world. And I had before that done a little teaching, not actually in schools, but at the University of London. And so in a sense, I followed slightly the same trajectory as he had, out of education and into business. That is an interesting experience to make because one of the things that Martin discovers is the pleasure of being able to be a pure advocate in business. You're not interested in coming up with a balanced argument with the pros and cons and all the rest of it. You're interested in promotion. You're interested in showing the best side of everything you do, the best side of your own products, of course, but also the best side of yourself. You're not terribly interested in highlighting any downsides. So it is an exercise in advocacy. Whereas in academe, of course, the exercise is always to try to be balanced and objective and impartial. And I think that's one of the things that Martin has to do. He has to go through this process of learning that it's a very different kind of world, working to different values. And he enjoys it. He enjoys it enormously. And so did I. I found it a lot of fun. I kept thinking of the rough and tumble. But the trouble is that occasionally the rough becomes very rough. And that's what Martin discovers too, that when it turns nasty, it can be extremely nasty. In most people's cases, nasty means the possibility of being disciplined or of being fired. In the book, of course, that leads further. It becomes fatal. And so that's the shock for him. It's this discovery of things that really are very unpleasant indeed, the underside of what he saw as something rather exciting. And at the time I wrote the book, actually, I was in a slightly curious position because I had fallen out with my boss extremely badly. But although we'd fallen out, he didn't fire me. What he did is he basically took away virtually all the work I had to do. So I was sat in the south of England, and my work was in the Midlands. And I hardly ever went into the office. I had very little to do. And so instead I decided to write a novel. And a lot of what I was going through then was in that, of course. It was the fact that I had the experience of a very bad falling out with a senior figure. He didn't kill me, but him either.
What fascinates me about this is that you say yourself that you've been, you know, kind of the enthralled, if not appalled, spectator of the loyalties, the noble and corrupt, the betrayals, the manipulations, the subversions that mark the relationships between the men and women whose work drive drives businesses, or whose leadership, speaking of your boss, takes them to success or failure. I think what I discovered is just that it's a far seedier world. Loyalties can change in an instant. Betrayals, it's not even something that you see happen. There have been times, because I'm not just fortunate enough to have read Good Company, but currently I'm fortunate enough, David is my critique partner, so I'm fortunate enough to be able to read End of the Road, which is the second book of his I've read. And it is not what you think, audience. I'm telling you, you get caught up and want, I think there's an element of suspense from the beginning of End of the Road to where I am in that book now. I've not even finished it, but there's an element of suspense that keeps driving me along. And the way that you started the book out, I know I said something about it because it was a very ominous start. And we talked about that because I really am torn. I'm not sure it would, I'm of two minds, because it was ominous, and yet with or without it, it's still ominous. Because the main character, Alex, is narrating as well, but we've got this just kind of penultimate man-child in Craig. And I know I'm leaping to a different book, but there are similarities in the two books. They are about the business world. They are about sales. And I was absolutely gobsmacked at what you had managed to do. I know you're not going to be able to answer this, but I have been dying. David and I have communicated by email, solely by email. This is the first time we've been able to talk. And so if I gush, trust me, there's reason to gush. If you haven't been to my Goodreads page, I review things as I see them. Even those bestsellers that you hear about all the time, I will give them exactly what I think of them. But David's work, it's so effortless. Does it just roll out of your head that way, or do you have to make extensive revisions to make it so effortless?
Oh, I find it's a very, very long process. Good Company's been 20 years in the writing, even though there was a long gap in the middle press. It's been 10 years, really. But I'm certainly on the major rewrite 5. So, I think this will be the last, but it has been heavily rewritten. When I first set out to write it, I thought, well, what can I write? What do I know how to write? And I realized that what I wrote most and wrote with greatest ease was letters. So in those days, I was switching over to email, but I still wrote a great many snail mail letters. So I thought I'd do it as an epistolary novel. So I wrote it, a whole bunch of letters. It was Martin's letters home to a friend of his called Tom, who's still in the novel. But people just don't like epistolary novels. I think it's something that worked in the 18th century. It's really not the way people like to read novels these days. And also,
you
I have to say
have
that I think...
that work? Because I would read that in a heartbeat.
Well,
no, I'm not joking. I'm not joking for a minute, because you've picked up on my odd little Victorian. You pointed it out to me, and I could not even tell you, because I've read Victorian-style novels where they have the three little ellipses. Right? And I just fell head over heels for that. But I love that. I love the whole concept of letters to his brother. I have read plenty of work like that. If you have that draft, I want it. I'm just going to put that up there.
Well, it's a pleasure. In any case, I think that in rewriting it, I also improved it. I think it's a much better work than it was then. Whether it's good enough to please an audience other than you and I and a few others is another matter. But it's a better book than it was. But it's certainly only got to being a bit better by taking a lot of work. I don't think there's anything effortless about making things effortless. I'm delighted it came across to you that way, but it does take a lot of effort.
Well, it still does, because, you sent me over what you referred to as kind of a hasty, rough draft. I've yet to find anything. It kind of cows me, because you view my work as well. it cows me because it's effortless. There are very few, as I like to say, bass-ackwards phrases. You rarely, you know, you expect, I expected going in, I'd find at least a few periods where they didn't belong or a few issues that could be resolved. I think I found a grand total of two in two manuscripts so far, and those were just story issues. It must be your extensive revision, because the best bit about having you look at my work is that you are someone who is more patient and who will give it all the time it deserves. I fly by the seat of my pants, I edit, and then I send it out to you, and luckily your critique is such that I can see mainly that a while is two different words, that my chapters are numbered properly, and I have a tendency to say things very much backwards. I don't know where I picked it up. You know, one thing about that is I know some of the ways that I write, and it's not proper. It's not the way you should do it. You correct me every time very graciously without wondering if I ever graduated any school whatsoever, primary included. But some of it is I started reading so early. It's supposed to improve your grammar and the way you say things, but somewhere along the way, it kind of got me backwards. You're a voracious reader. What do you most like to read?
Well, at the moment, funny enough, I'm really reading two kinds of things. You were just talking about the 19th century novel. I'm a French graduate, and I read a lot of French literature at different times, and I've felt over the last 10 or 20 years that I didn't know my own languages and my own cultures, literature, anything like well enough. So I've gone back to trying to fill out a bit my reading of, in particular, a 19th century novel. To my shame, until a few weeks ago, I had read no Bronte at all, and now I've read Jane Eyre, and that's it. I'm a great lover of Elizabeth Gaskell. I've read some of her novels before, but I've gone back to reading some more now. I read Middlemarch recently, so you know, I feel like I'm steeping myself to some extent into an area that was a bit of a desert to me before. I knew Dickens well, but that was about all. But I'm also fascinated, for reasons that to some extent I haven't great difficulty explaining, by American history. And I've had down the years read an awful lot about different aspects of American history. And in the last year or so, I've taken to going through a number of biographies. So rather than reading general histories, which I was reading before, I've gone into biographies of some of the great figures of early American history. I started off really at the beginning of the United States, not at the beginning of the English colonization of America, but the beginning of the United States. So I've been reading biographies of Jefferson, John Adams, and a rather interesting account of the relationship between Jefferson and the great Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, at that time. And at the moment, I'm in the middle of a large biography of Washington, a man who I've never really understood. I've always been slightly amazed at how much he's admired. I think he's an impressive man, but I think others around him were much more so. So there you go. That's essentially, at the moment, I'm reading a lot of 19th century novels and biographies of American men of the late 18th, early 19th centuries.
I think, especially where George Washington is concerned, what I find the most fascinating about him is that he was held in such high regard when he had kind of been on the side of the English and then he went on the side of just the Americas. And I guess I, as an American, was never able to really reconcile his greatness with the fact that once upon a time he was on the side of the English against the French and committed some, not entirely pleasant activities in pursuit of that goal. And I suppose I always felt that he turned and bit the hand that fed him, so to speak, which is bizarre. I understand that this is bizarre for any patriots, as it were, listening. This is just my personal view. I've never understood it, having looked back over history to see it. And certainly, I think George Washington beautifully illustrates how Americans can be at times, how we can be very for something one day, and then the mark of an adolescent country is then the next day we'll have nothing to do with it. So I find him, having been taught history of George Washington, I found it, given the conditions that he commanded in, he must have had enormous personal charisma.
I'm sure he did. I mean, his physical courage is undisputed. He rode regularly into fire. The most extraordinary thing about him is that he was never wounded in all the fighting he did. But, you know, I think the business, I mean, that, you raise a question which is always fascinating me, this business about how could they, well, were they biting the hand that fed them? I think that the only way to understand what was going on is to see them as Englishmen. This is not, you know, the old myth that Paul Revere rode through the countryside shouting, "The British are coming, the British are coming," it's nonsense. Of course he didn't call that, because it would have been meaningless. He was British, and he was riding through villages full of British people. It would have been a senseless thing to say. What he said was, "The Redcoats are coming." People knew what that meant. It meant that the British army was coming to put down British citizens, which it had done many times in Britain, after all. There was nothing new about that. And, you know, the British army was the tool. You know, every state, one of the definitions of a state is that it has a monopoly of ultimate violence. The British army was the tool of ultimate violence of the British state, and it used it to impose order, which meant its order. And I think what happened in America was that a lot of loyal and thoroughly respectable British citizens realized that Britain was treating them as second class, and that it was becoming unbearable to go on living that way, in exactly the same way as Oliver Cromwell rose against King Charles the century before. He didn't see himself as any less British for doing it. The only difference in the American case is that these guys lived 3,000 miles away, and therefore, when they rose, they could identify with a new nation, which hadn't previously existed. But I do believe that people like Otis in Massachusetts, or indeed Sam Adams, saw themselves as British men, and perhaps specifically as English men, fighting for the rights of Englishmen everywhere.
Right. And that's where things like the Boston Tea Party are kind of misinterpreted. Just based on what you've said, you know, these were Englishmen protesting. That's exactly what they were doing.
Mistreatment by other Englishmen, and that mistreatment took the form of trampling on the historical rights of Englishmen everywhere. And in fact, I mean, if you read things like Jefferson's, I can't remember what the title of the piece was, but he wrote a piece in around 1773-1772, talking about the grievances of the English colonists in America, he refers to not just the rights of modern English people, but the original Anglo-Saxons, from whom he says the rights of English people derived throughout their existence in Britain and were carried by them to the new English colonies in the States. In America, I should say. And therefore, what was being trampled on were traditional English rights whose roots were way back in Germany.
Well, you know what interests me in this is that you look at all sides of the view in your quest to kind of understand, absorb, learn the history of the states, which I call them. I don't always say America myself, but do you bring that sort of from all sides view to good company and end of the road? Because I think you do. I think the same curiosity and learning, and especially your teaching, I can see your teaching influence in how you write for people like me who have absolutely no understanding whatsoever of the business world, and yet you make it fascinating. Do you think that owes in part to your teaching experience?
Yes, maybe so. That's an interesting point. I haven't thought of it that way. In the same way as I suppose Martin gets away from teaching and he gets away from the need to be balanced and he can take sides, maybe I am writing from the point of view of a certain academic impartiality. Certainly, I mean, you say that some of my characters are loathsome, and that's fine. I have no problem with that because then, I want them to be loathsome. But I would also like them to be seen as having their own motivations. They don't see themselves as loathsome.
No, absolutely not. And you write that in there.
Yeah, good. There are characters who behave extremely badly, but then at other times, they behave far better, and Martin is astonished by it when he sees the other sides of their characters. Even when he gets a little inclined to write them off as a little stupid, uninformed, perhaps ill-educated, they then amaze him with the fact that they have insights and far greater intelligence than he suspected. Though maybe it's an intelligence of a different kind. And maybe that's what I'm trying to do, is take that point of view that says, look, there are many types of intelligence, and it's very easy to think that there's only really a book-learning type of intelligence when there are many other types. In many ways, one of the other characters in the book, Colin, who is actually the immediate boss of Martin, although Martin tends to work much more with the chief executive of the company, a chap called Jim. Colin is a very learned man and intellectual, and he fails to see that there is another kind of intelligence, and that his nemesis, Jim, also has skill and talent and intelligence, but it's of a completely different kind.
Yeah, he fails to even acknowledge it. And yet, you know what? Colin, there are some people, there are some readers who would not like Colin. There would some people who would probably say that he's a bit too intellectual, too removed. And yet, I felt for his struggle, and there is definitely a struggle there. I felt for his struggle, and I was on his side, much more than the more affable boss. I was much more, I was actually, the way that you do things is so subtle. You don't outright say, there are no huge revelations. It all flows beautifully in that you trust Colin. I trusted Colin more than ever I did Jim. I knew that he had his own particular way of viewing the world. I didn't deem it right or wrong, but I gravitated to him much more than I did Jim. And if I had to assign a theme to good company, everyone says that you should know what the theme to your novel is. Well, my opinion is that the theme is nothing more nor less than life. The theme of that novel is life, because all the variations that you can go through, the ups, the downs, the tragedies, the culmination of lots of hard work and effort, everything you will encounter in a life, Martin encounters. That's the theme. You speak of some of the tragedies, and I remember them vividly, and yet those take place in our lives as well. It literally is a theme of life. It's not average. It's not mundane. It's brilliantly rendered. And you feel what you should for every single character, and you pull that off effortlessly.
Well, that's very kind. I mean, certainly I wouldn't like them to be just novels about business. They're set in a business context. But yes, you're absolutely right. I want to write about life.
And that's it. You succeed brilliantly. And I think Good Company was written before End of the Road, correct?
That's right, yes.
So you're showing a mastery, as far as I'm concerned, an absolute mastery of making what could be one-note kind of man-children in Craig specifically. You succeed in making him someone the readers root for, despite some of the cavalier attitude he projects even towards himself. So you, to me, you're evolving as a writer, because I've read Good Company. I still don't know what happens to Craig, but that's not my fault, is it? Right, David. I still don't know what happens to him, but there is a pervasive, there's nothing overt at all. There's a pervasive dread, and you root for Craig even when the poor dear is making all the wrong decisions. Martin is a very different character, and indeed Alex from End of the Road, Alex is the narrator of End of the Road, and he, you root for him as well. Was it kind of a decision of yours to remove Alex a little more from the narrative and make Craig come forward? Because Alex is there. You care about Alex. You want to hear good things about Alex. You want to see throughout, he's worked so hard, he's lost so much. I want to see him reap rewards. I positively tense up any time it looks as if things won't go well for him. He's the good, upstanding, hardworking, knows he'll have to take loss narrator. Craig can be a bit of a buffoon, but you root for him the entire time. I don't think you had a character as vivid. I mean vivid, because you write Craig in such a vivid, we all know Craig. We know someone who is kind of blustery, very loud, very confident when perhaps they shouldn't be. Was that based on anyone or a collection of people that you've met in the past?
It's very much a portrait, yes, of somebody I worked with. And, I mean, he is the central character of the novel. In fact, as you know, I originally called it Craig's Story. So I see Alex as narrating Craig's story. But as we were talking a little while ago, I think you were just making the same point. It's time for Alex to become a little higher profile in the book himself, his own story to come out a little more. But it is very much the story of Craig rather than the story of Alex.
But it's handled very well. I know if you have me as a reader at the point where I am delighted when I discover something with a character named Carol. I don't want to give any secrets away, but when I discover this line, just one brief sentence, I am thrilled for Alex. So you see, he never, you have the balance perfect where it may be about Craig, but you care very much about Alex. And it's clear the whole time he's very much a person in his own right. So I would say to you that you have in no way faltered in what you're attempting to do there. You have succeeded totally and wholly. That's it.
Good.
Very
well,
forthright in my opinions.
It's a very encouraging opinion. I suppose in a sense the story is the relationship between Craig and Alex, but I do think that Craig is the central core figure.
He is, and I can't see, it's difficult for me to see anyone not rooting for Craig. But before I forget, we need to go to a really quick break. Talking to David is just putting me beyond and over every schedule there is, because I'm just so delighted to have the opportunity to talk to him. I have no idea what we're going to talk about when we get back. You can guarantee it's going to be about his creations and his process in creating them. But we will be back after a short break. You are listening to Lydia's Literary Lowdown on WGGM.
Hello, everyone. B. Delosier here with a rundown of GGM Radio's brand new schedule. Boy, have we got some wonderful new programs with great new hosts. A little something for everyone. On Mondays at 11 a.m. Central, it's Messages of Light with Amanda Dowell for an hour of psychic chat and inspirational guests. Mondays at 7 p.m. Central, it's time for Primarily Paranormal with psychic Tina Marie. Share an hour with Tina and Bob Weber of Gulf Coast Paranormal. On the second and fourth Tuesday of every month at 8 p.m. Central, it's the Back to Brilliance Hour with Lynn Hoft and Vivian Hildebrand, an hour devoted to your spiritual growth. Wednesdays start at 11 a.m. Central with Maggie Holbeck and Crystal Clear Coaching, featuring motivational inspiration to get your life back on track. At 1 p.m. Central, join Claudia Cleary on Wednesdays with Namaste Nutrition for an hour of soothing chat all about good health, positivity, and spiritual balance. Thursdays, start your day at 9 a.m. Central with Nancy Murdoch and Mastering the Art of Joyfulness. Let Nancy and her special guests lift you out of that rut and get you back in your groove. At 8 p.m. Central, join Dr. Gregory Scott for the Light Giver Universal Healer Hour. Gregory offers spiritual education to further you along your path to enlightenment and empowerment. Fridays at 12 noon Central, it's Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Join Brenda for an hour of inspiration and motivation, featuring a lineup of today's most popular authors and guests. Friday night at 7 p.m. Central, enjoy an hour of psychic chat with spot-on reader Tasha Harris and the Angels Network. Saturdays begin at noon Central with Bea Delosier, yours truly, and the Metaphysical Edge for psychic chat and interesting guests ranging from UFO research, paranormal experiencers, and all things metaphysical. At 2 p.m. Central on Saturday, it's Audrey Quinn and My Beauty Angel, an hour created just for you with tips and tricks on how to be the best you can be with what God has given you. Sunday is a day of service here on Greater Good Ministries Radio, each week featuring a different interfaith minister bringing joy, upliftment, and unfoldment for body, mind, and spirit. First Sunday of the month is Conversations Beyond the Edge with Dr. Gregory Scott. The second Sunday of the month is the Empowerment Hour with Reverend Barbara B. Delosier. Third Sunday of the month is the Light Givers International Sunday Service and Worldwide Source a Nation Celebration. The fourth Sunday of the month is In His Presence with Evangelist Patricia Benneman. Hope you will join us live for all of our Greater Good Ministries radio programs, but if you can't be with us in person, you can hear any of our programs on demand in archives at www.blogtalkradio.com/ggmradio. And remember, all of our programs now stream live from our home site, www.ggmradio.com. Wishing everyone warmest blessings, always in love, light, and sound. Music provided by Orville Bird, musician extraordinaire. Visit him at orvillebird.com and get a hold of all of Orville's wonderful music.
Welcome back to Lydia's Literary Lowdown. As I said throughout the show, I'm going to say it again. I get so fascinated talking to David about anything and everything there can be that I forget to do little things like come back from break on time. What we were talking about was actually religion. And these are themes, by the way, you can absolutely see now and again on David's blog. They are things now and again I will write about, but you really do need to check out David Beeson, Random Views at blogspot.com. Better yet, just Google him. It'll come right up. Instead of, I'm a very simple person, as my audience knows. I Google whoever I want to find out about, then I read their blog. Google David Beeson or follow him on Twitter. He's marvelous. It's David Beeson 2. So we were talking about religion, which I believe informs the way that we write, especially I can see it in Good Company, and I can see it in End of the Road. Here's how. It's not there. And because it's not there, you don't have summary kind of characters that are summarily dismissed, looked down upon, or anything like that. But you were mentioning how, in light of the awful attack on the soldier in London, now Muslims are being attacked. Carry on from there.
Yes, I mean, I think that the way the world is behaving around Islam is, you know, one of the great tragedies of our time. On both sides of the fence, I think fundamentalist Islamists are behaving extremely badly. And our reaction to them is pretty much, it could hardly be calculated to increase tension any more. So, yes, I find that one of the saddest aspects of our time. So what happened in Woolwich is that a young man who had chosen to go into the army was, you know, brutally and unnecessarily hacked to pieces, literally hacked to pieces with meat cleavers by two young men in the street. One of those young men had himself been the victim of a knife attack when he was 16. So one feels that it's, you know, that trauma has left him in a state where he would do this again to himself. Now the two of them turned to Islam, but it feels to me as though what they really had was violence in themselves, that they was looking for a way out, and Islam became nothing more than the pretext for the behavior they adopted. The reaction has been, in certain circles anyway, to respond with violence towards Muslims. So Muslims have been attacked in the street, mosques have been attacked, even though the Muslim community in this country, which is one of the most law-abiding we have, the Muslim community has spoken out very loudly on many occasions against the attack. And from across the spectrum, there are very conservative Muslims have spoken out. There have been much more radical Muslims. There's a huge majority of the Muslim community in this country is deeply opposed to this kind of behavior. But they're nonetheless now victims of it. And that seems to be the price of a certain kind of devout belief, a sense that our community is right and your community is wrong, and it seems to occur on both sides of the divide. And as I said before, I find that one of the biggest problems of our time and one of the saddest.
Right. I'm just any religion that advocates that you have to be right or you have to be better than someone else is not a religion I'm interested in. Any religion that preaches you have to preach that people are going to burn forever in a lake of fire, Christianity, I don't understand the purpose. Well, I do. Unfortunately, I do. From long experience that you and I have both seen, and we see this theme in literature all the time, which is someone literally always has to be on the bottom now, don't they?
That's right. Yes.
And someone has to be the moral finger pointing us in the right direction. The problem is that there are many fingers, and they're all pointing at one another and saying, kill this one, kill that one. I don't know what happened to thou shalt not kill, which is found in the Bible, and similar statements can be found in almost any religious text, and yet we've lost it somewhere along the way. It always, you know, in the States in particular, if it's not religion, you don't even have to look to religion to see who's at the bottom or who's despised or who's not going to be saved or not get to wherever they need to go after they die. You have but to look at the scapegoats that we've made and kicked about for some sort of sadistic pleasure for years. African Americans, no Irish need apply, the German community, Swedish, there are very few immigrants who have come over who have not been persecuted in spite of the freedom of religion, the right to life and happiness, all of this. And now the most, for now, and I have faith that the gay community is going to, they're making strides forward, and I think in the next decade, I'm hoping that they won't be at the bottom. What terrifies me is who will next.
Yes. Well, I think, I'm taking specifically the question of religion. The word comes from a Latin root meaning to tie together, to bind together. And you know, that is, I suppose, the greatest advantage, the greatest benefit of religion is that it pulls people together into a community. The trouble is, the moment you bound people into a community, you've also defined a border, haven't you?
Right.
There's those who are inside it and those who are outside it. And this works for religion, but it also works with other things like sexual orientation, as you just mentioned. To be honest, in times gone by, it's worked on things like left-handedness. The right-handed community is a community and the left-handed community is outside it.
Right.
And the problem is that there's a very simple psychological mechanism that goes from they're outside to they're different, from they're different to they're wrong, from they're wrong to they're sinful. And when you get to there, really there's very little to stop you burning them, killing them in any other way, generally persecuting such people. So the moment you've set up a boundary and defined the inside against the outside, you've created the possibility of persecution. Now, I think one could have religion where without persecution. I've often thought of the ideal, not often achieved by Hindus, of positive tolerance, which says you're of a different religion from mine, but you want to build a temple. Let me help you build it. Now, that I think would be the most positive kind of religion one can imagine. I'm a Catholic or whatever, but you're a Jew and you want a synagogue. Let me help you get the bricks.
Right.
At that point, I think religion would become a huge force for good. But at the moment, as it stands now, as it becomes a way of saying you are doing things wrong, you've had an abortion, or you're attracted to members of the same sex as yourself, or you're a Muslim, and therefore you are somehow alien and evil. And when it behaves in that way, it's a major force for negativity in the world.
Right, and I happen to be left-handed. And you read Year of the Hybrid. And I would say if your theme is life, and I really think both books, you can view the life exactly what it's supposed to be. When I think of Pachelbel's Canon, for instance, I absolutely adore that. I can listen to it literally for 8 hours or more at a time. But the reason that I like it isn't because it was playing at my wedding. The reason I like it is because when I listen to it, I listen to life, ups, downs, slow, fast. I think your books function in much the same way. But my book, Year of the Hybrid, which I only am because of the thread that our conversation is taking, I think the theme for that would be what many people find outside of the borders you've described, which is what it is to be outside. But what I wanted to play with within that world is not only are they outside, but they're also going to be looked upon per virtue of what they are. And the most I know this is cruel to say, but the most interesting bit, if not even a bit amusing to me, is that a lot of times the fear of the outsider, the casting them to the bottom, in this particular book, they're casting people to the bottom who are at the top. And I'm intrigued. This is going to be a series, there's no doubt. One way or another, I will get it out of me. But the reason I bring it up is because I've always been fascinated with the interplay of religion, with the people who have to be on bottom. As I said before, it's a theme often seen in literature. I wanted to play on the fact that this is clearly outside. Human beings are disgusted by hybrids, who are, the best description would be, kind of, they have human minds, but they have zombie strength. They don't run around eating humans because they have human minds. yet they have increased strength. They're stronger than humans. They're stronger than zombies. They can rip both apart. And I find it fascinating.
Yes. It's a fascinating idea that the persecuted minority is actually the most powerful community. It's a very, very interesting idea, which I think you treat extremely well.
Yeah, that's what I want to play with, because that's something I'm quite familiar with. If you write what you know, well, my day job is something that's hardly looked upon with approval. But I like the thought, and indeed, I think this has been demonstrated. I think we have seen this, not just in my book, but when I think of the Holocaust, I think of the strength of the survivors, of the incredible strength for them to make it out of that ordeal and to survive. So in my mind, they will always be on top in strength, in dignity and grace. They will always be on top of those who sought to kind of bring them down. That kind of strength is mental. It can be physical, but the strength I wanted to explore for my book is this is a population who could, if they put their minds together, take over the earth if they really wanted to. And that is not, by the way, David, a spoiler. Just so
No, I understand. I appreciate that. No, I think you've got a really fascinating theme there, and an exciting story, which I found gripping, compelling to read. You know, you want to read on, and I think it's fascinating because it contrasts with, in many ways, related themes, but a very different story in your other book, which I've been reading, which is Mortas.
Right.
Where it's much more lighthearted. So I thought that was fascinating that you were able to handle related themes in a very different way, in a very different tone. So, you know, I think that takes great skill and enviable skill.
Well, I would definitely reflect the mirror back to you. And you've not seen the other things I have. I always think that one would be particularly interested, but it's nowhere near fit, you've seen. It's just not. But it does deal quite a bit with history. You could call it an alternate mythology. And because I know you like history, I thought the broad, like the forest for the trees theme here, you might actually be interested in that. But it's not ready, and we shouldn't be talking about me anyway, which is why I held up the mirror and said, you really have a talent, and I'm just hoping that you can find an agent or decide to publish, because it sounds like you're wanting to go the traditional route to me. Is that so?
Oh, well, not necessarily. I mean, I'm also thinking about just simply going straight out to as an e-book on Amazon or whatever. I thought I might try to see if I can find an agent first, but only give it a few weeks or two or three months or whatever, and then if that doesn't seem to be working, just publish on Amazon.
Well, I can tell you right now, as someone who reads indie authors all the time, this is ready, in my opinion. I know you're working some things on Good Company, and I'm eager to see that. However, I can say that you're nearly finished. I would hate to see 2, 5, 10 more years of edits because you don't need it. You just do not.
I agree with you entirely.
Frankly,
whether it's outstanding or not, it's done.
Right, and that's that's where I want to see this in print. I will buy it in print. It does not matter that I read it. I will buy it in print because it is
That's
that
very
good.
Kind of you.
Well, it is something that you can continue to go back to and read. And I think you will. I'm not sure if you'll believe this or not, but I know if I go back and read it again, I'm going to pick up on a different layer of meaning than I did the first time. I am a compulsive rereader. When I collect a book, when I invest in a book, it is known ahead of time I will read that book up to 50, 100, maybe more times in whatever's left of my life. So this is a book that you can read and read again, and I'm very eager for Good Company to come out and for End of the Road to be out there. And, of course, while I have you here on the spot, is there anything else in the horizon that you're thinking of doing?
Well, I've drafted another novel some time ago, which I'm much less happy about. But once I've gone through end of the road, I might go back to that and see whether I can make something better of it. I'm highly interested in the French 18th century, and in particular Voltaire. And one of the things that Voltaire did was write with assumed innocence about terrible abuses, and so he could be extremely funny about them. Obviously the great book that people know the most is Candide, which is the candid young man walking into a world that is anything but innocent and seeing it through innocent eyes. And it can be hilariously funny when he describes awful things being done, and he describes them in the most matter-of-fact way, whether it's soldiers punishing one of their own number for some minor offense, or whether it's terrible killings of slaves or enemy or whatever taking place. It's all made to look very funny because it's seen through the eyes of an innocent. And so I did write a book, I did actually finish it, involving an alien arriving from somewhere else on a study trip. He's here to research this little-known corner of the universe, and he comments on what he sees and the strange peculiarities of the way we live. But it didn't really work, and I need to go back to it.
You've already got me. I'm already ready. I'm ready. Because you do bring to bear observations I didn't think every single person would see, and there is a innocence. I think what you've described, to some respect, describes Martin, who is very much an innocent in good company. He is an innocent, and he does get schooled in the ways of the world, particularly the business world, but not just that, in heartbreak, in love, in so many other things. I would stress to listeners, this is not just about business world. There are no boring parts, and you've taken it a step further, I think. But the interesting thing is the juxtaposition to me, because in good company, Martin is the innocent. He's exactly as you've described. And then we come to End of the Road, where you've got a more knowing Alex, who is still very pure, very innocent, loath to be disloyal to his friend Craig, and yet he still sees the truths there. So he remains a character with huge integrity and yet very human at the same time, in that he gets a bit tired of taking on board Craig's attitudes and errors at times.
Yes, I think at times he becomes quite harsh. I think
but
he's quite self-aware, and he feels bad when
characters.
He gets harsh. Sorry?
Not compared to other characters. I think Alex needs that knowingness, but you know what? It doesn't matter how harsh Alex is. At the end of the day, you know he wants Craig to succeed. He may say he has a morbid fascination with how things might unravel at this point or another, or have unraveled for Craig. But whenever you look at it, Luke, another character who works alongside both Craig and Alex, is much more damning, if you will.
Much more, yes. To him, it's all much more black and white, whereas I think Alec is more self-aware and more muted in his reactions, inclined to put himself in Craig's position, I think, is what he does. He thinks, would I necessarily have behaved better? How would I feel if I was subject to this kind of criticism? And even when it's him who's producing the criticism himself, he feels bad because he knows that Craig must be deeply upset by it.
Right, and what's fascinating about that is I agree with Alex, and I appreciate his efforts because I treasure loyalty in any friend, and yet at the same time, I completely understand where Luke is coming from. Some of the things that he says are harsh, and they're very, very true. And I think what I took from that was, well, good. He sees it the way it is, and while Alex has his stance, which is to protect his friend, it's not the same at all for Luke. Luke calls it as he sees it.
That's right.
And you know what? We're almost at the end of the show. I want to remind you about those letters. Send those to me because I am quite fascinated with that. It would put a whole new slant on this world in good company, I already know. And thank you so much. It has been such a joy and privilege to speak to you today.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you, and I'm glad that you're seeing the characters the way I want you to see them.
Exactly.
So thanks very much.
And I will be looking for you again whenever, whichever way this goes, I will absolutely be haranguing you for another interview so we can talk about the book. More readers will have had an opportunity to see, which is good company.
Well, many thanks, and I'll be more than happy anytime you want.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope you have a lovely night. Get to sleep because it's a bit late there.
No problem, man. You have a very good evening.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, everyone. Next week, we are fortunate enough to have Casey Ryan on the show. I absolutely adore him. I was fortunate enough to be able to do an interview with him last October. Casey Ryan is the creator and host of The Cutting Room Floor. It's a talk radio podcast and blog. I am so looking forward to seeing him next week. Everyone have a very safe and happy Memorial Day, and we will talk to you next week with guest Casey Ryan.